This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, rich people try to make us like them by giving money away, but their philanthropy is all about staying in power. And feminism looks and sounds different to a landless African woman in Uganda than it does to a rich white woman in the United States.
But first, President Donald Trump used his State of the Union address to proclaim that there will never be a socialist government in the United States. We spoke with Dr. Anthony Montero, the Philadelphia-based Du Boisian scholar.
The speech itself was a demonstration of cheap political campaign rhetoric. And therefore, I don't see anything in it that one who is interested seriously in the direction of human history would take very seriously. On the one side, I saw his attack upon socialism, an attempt to define the Democratic Party, which is a joke, his claim, as a left-wing socialist party. Anybody that knows anything could not take that seriously. Even the so-called socialists in the Democratic Party, I don't consider socialist. Now, on the other side, if he is saying, which maybe he is, that there'll never be another New Deal kind of restructuring or reforming of capitalism, maybe that can be taken seriously and that can be debated. But even on that score, he stands on very, very thin ice, because another great recession, which would be greater than the last 2008 Great Recession, would, in all likelihood, as most commentators are suggesting, morph into something that looks like a Great Depression. And to save not just capitalism, but to save the rule of the ruling class itself would require reforms of a New Deal type. So it's not to be taken seriously. I am not yet prepared to even take what are called socialists seriously as socialists. Now, we can talk a little bit more about that. But I just think the whole discussion of Trump attacking socialists and socialists saying, look, we must be very powerful since Trump attacked us, I think is just a performance on all sides.
Well, certainly a national single-payer health care system is not socialist, or it does not mean that we have a socialist system. After all, most of the rest of the industrial world already has such a system.
Right. And most of the non-industrial world, or the developing economies, such as China and Vietnam and North Korea, and probably South Korea, have that. I should also mention Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. So the United States, in terms of caring for its people and it being the responsibility ultimately of the state to care for vital needs of the people, we are an outvalue. Most people and nations in the world have accepted a form of capitalism, which also recognizes that to have political and social stability, you have to provide something for the people, and you have to regulate the inherent tendencies of capitalism to produce wide inequalities. Our economic model is perhaps unique in the world in regards to not being concerned about that, and a capitalism, as Martin Luther King said, socialism for the rich and rugged individualism for the working class and poor. So we're out of touch with the trajectory of history and with humanity, which I should say, by the way, Glenn, because we do not provide those things at the level of the government, because we have this ruthless form of capitalism, it makes our nation more ripe for rebellion and even revolutionary change than would be the case in nations that provide those things, such as Sweden, such even as England or France.
Well, in terms of being out of touch, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party seem to be out of touch with the base voters. 70% and more of Americans as a whole support this slew of proposals made by Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez. We're talking about single payer, but also free college tuition, Ocasio-Cortez's proposal to raise tax rates on the rich to 70%, and of course, that Green New Deal proposal, the outlines of which have been revealed already, and which call for a total overhaul of the U.S. economy, not just its industrial parts.
Yeah, the fact that they do it from within the Democratic Party, to me, indicates that these are talking points, and they will be talked to death, and that they're not serious in terms of creating the political conditions among the great mass of people. As you say, 70 and 80% of Democrats in particular support a kind of Green New Deal and universal health care without the insurance companies. But the fact that these proposals are made from within the Democratic Party and not from the standpoint of a mass movement suggests to me that they are not serious in terms of being implemented and are, in the end, talking points for the 2020 election and soon after that to be dropped and forgotten. So I hope you would forgive me for my skepticism. I am not cynical, I'm skeptical of a group of socialists who would prefer, rather than building a socialist movement with a program to overhaul the system, are making proposals that look to be leaning in the direction of socialism from within a party that is dominated and controlled by, and in fact exists for the sake of keeping the 1% or the 1/10 of 1% or the corporate imperialists in power.
You seem to be predicting that the Democratic Party will accept these proposals that have super majorities and only dump them after the election, but accept them at convention. Many of us think that this Democratic Party will not allow these proposals to get to the convention, and that this rejection by the party of these supermajority backed proposals could lead to an explosion of the party and a huge defection of disgruntled leftish Democrats.
Well, this is what we're faced with. And, you know, to put it in really stark terms, the Democratic Party, like the Republican Party, face crises that are existential. These parties, for the majority of people, are no longer seen as legitimate and useful in the conduct of the people's business, in the pursuance of people's democratic aspirations, be they for health care, be they for a green economy or whatever. So, I think the Democratic Party is fighting a struggle to regain some legitimacy or to regain legitimacy as they go into the 2020 election. I don't think that these proposals are serious unless they are based upon building a movement in the industrial states, in these big cities, among the poor. I can think, as I always am thinking, about Philadelphia. Where are the mechanisms to build support for a green economy, for universal health care, and on and on and on? So that's my point. I don't think it's serious. I think the Democrats are trying to build a coalition for 2020. I think they face a real problem at their convention, because as long as they flirt with left, and I put quotes around that, of their party, and have to concede some things, at least in terms of talking points, it does suggest that there will be people who will take it seriously. And when they get to that convention and find out that, well, we could talk about these issues, but that's as far as it's going, then you might have an explosion on the floor of the Democratic Party convention. Something like you had in 2016 when they had to make the Sanders delegates invisible.
Of course, you're correct about movement politics, and we know where movement politics go during election years. And now we seem to be having a two-year election year. That is, the 2020 election year has already begun.
No question. And, you know, there's a historical precedent of sorts in the 1968 Democratic Party convention. Right now, I have to say, I don't take this left wing of the Democratic Party, including the DSA, serious. I think they want to talk issues to death, but they do not want to build the types of movements to make these talking points into policy. The other thing is, I don't consider it left unless, along with domestic proposals for reform, there is talk of cutting these huge military budgets and ending the U.S. war policies throughout the world.
And in fact, the Democratic Party went along with the Trump budget, which was even bigger than what Trump had asked for the military-industrial complex.
Absolutely, including Bernie Sanders, the most well-known socialist in the United States. So we're at the beginning of something, the end of something, and the beginning of something. I think we have to assess what is going on more clearly. I think included in any discussion of 2020 has to be the crisis of the U.S. dollar, which in many ways explains this Bolton Pompeo Trump coup d'etat or attempted coup d'etat in Venezuela. I think the response of China and Russia and Turkey and Iran to it has to do in large measure with this new aggressiveness with respect to, first of all, a multipolar world and a world that is no longer dominated by the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency. In that sense, if the U.S. dollar retreats or is forced to retreat, that means the cost of the U.S. military empire increases exponentially, which means in order to pay for the military empire, greater austerity at home. So you cannot detach the call for universal health care, getting rid of the insurance companies, a green economy, and on and on and on, without at the same time recognizing that the conditions that would have made that possible and the assumptions that you would have to have made to make that possible, let us say 20 or 30 years ago. And that assumption was that the dollar had a privileged place in the world, which means you could have both a military empire and presumably a welfare state at home. I think those assumptions have to be thrown to the side. I think what might be driving more of this and the crisis could be the rise of multiple currencies, including the petrol yuan and other currencies, even the euro under certain conditions that challenge the dollar, which then makes the U.S. military empire too expensive to continue. In that kind of circumstance, a real left would have to be in place or arise to explain the conditions that the American working people and poor and middle class face and the path forward. At this point, that is not taking place. And for that reason, I find much of the talk about, you know, we'll give the working class all of these things, just vote Democrat in 2020, I find it bad faith and disingenuous.
That was Du Boisian scholar Dr. Anthony Montera speaking from Philadelphia.
A handful of rich people own more wealth than half the world's population, and just 3 billionaires own more wealth than half the people in the United States. But rich people claim that society is better off because of their wealth. Carl Rhodes disagrees. Rhodes is a professor of organization studies at the University of Technology in Sydney, Australia. He's co-author of a recent article on the ways that rich people justify their status in society by giving some of their money away.
Some people put this under the name of philanthrocapitalism, where philanthropy and capitalism become merged. Now, traditionally, of course, we would have thought of charity as involving giving and capitalism as the pursuit of financial self-interest. But it seems in the present day, we're told that this classic opposition no longer exists. And you can be a hugely wealthy billionaire who's made money through whatever means possible and still be charitable. And there's many examples of this. You know, there's Warren Buffett and Bill Gates in 2010, for example, formed the Giving Pledge, where they encouraged billionaires to pledge donations, often, you know, huge amounts of wealth to the public good. And it's interesting, you have this growth of this kind of charitable work, but it hasn't done anything to halt inequality. If anything, it just goes to justify the political and economic system that produced the inequality in the first place. Giving away some money is a small price to pay for justifying the system that enables the wealthy to continue to be wealthy. So although, while on the one hand, it might think, oh, isn't it nice that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is giving away a few million, nothing really changes in terms of equality as a result of this, and possibly it even gets worse.
Yes, if billionaires give money to causes of their own choosing, causes that tend to give the impression that billionaires and the rest of us are compatible, that society can continue like that, then it's really not charity at all. It's politically shaping the society to make it easier for them to dominate it.
Exactly. I mean, it's self-interest just done in a much more sophisticated way. But the other thing, I mean, it's almost a kind of return to a kind of feudal society where the poor survive on the crumbs that fall from the tables of the rich. And importantly here, too, it's not just about charity, it's about what are the implications of this for democracy. For democracy, where the good of people and kind of public services and so forth are increasingly funded by individual rich people, as you say, based on whatever their own habits or preferences are. This is a far cry from even the American tradition of government by the people and for the people. This is government by the super wealthy. This is reversing what little progress in history we've had in terms of the advent of democracy.
It is now almost common knowledge in the United States that 3 billionaires control more wealth than half of the population of the United States. And we can make similar comparisons in terms of billionaires and world worth. Are they getting scared now that people know just how lopsided the world really is, wealth-wise?
I suspect so, because it's becoming increasingly divided, and particularly now that there's more knowledge of it, which has happened as a result of a lot of kind of important social activist work in terms of bringing these issues to public awareness. But I think they are, because, and it's not just individual billionaires, corporations as well, because if you look at it on a global scale, the world's 10 biggest corporations have revenues that exceed the combined domestic products of the 180 least wealthy nations. So this is really a situation where corporations are becoming the powerful players in global politics and economy, more powerful than the states that created them in the first place. It's almost like Frankensteinian in terms of what's been created in this sense.
Why is it considered so mysterious? Classic socialism predicted 100-something years ago that capitalism would continue to consolidate.
I mean, to my mind, what's mysterious is why the socialist promise or the socialist prediction hasn't come true. I mean, even if you go back 10 years at the, you know, the fall of Lehman Brothers and the global financial crisis, if there was any ever a time that the legitimacy of capitalism was going to be questioned, that should have been it. That should have been a time, it could have been predicted, where things could change. But by all accounts, we've actually kind of gone back to where we were before, if not capitalism having been even strengthened as a way out of the financial crisis. So on the one hand, the predictions of historical socialism would have said this would have ended the system. But capitalism, I think, seems more resilient than was expected.
Yes, of course, classic socialism did predict, however, the concentration of wealth. We usually talk in terms of wealth about actual dollars and rubles and other denominations of money. But now we have a thing called derivatives that are sloshing around the world at nominal values, 20 times the actual gross product of the world.
Yeah, I mean, the whole general kind of financialization of the contemporary global economy, I mean, it makes it, on the one hand, kind of bigger, as you suggest, and also significantly more complex. And I think this is part of it, too. I mean, it becomes then only experts who are able to understand how this works, where regular citizens are kind of lost when things move away from what we know in terms of money. So that becomes a problem in many ways.
Well, understanding that these derivatives are inventions, instruments of the rich, if we concede that only the experts hired by the rich can understand them, then we have actually just given up control of the whole idea of what wealth is, not just who has it.
Yeah, indeed. It really kind of stresses the importance of financial literacy to democratic citizenship. And this is something that certainly isn't the case. So you have a system that the rich benefit from and from which only they might have access to the people who are able to manage and control that system, which results in a further kind of inequality and marginalization of the people, of the citizens of particular nations and of the world more generally.
When demands arise that the rich be taxed more heavily, the counterpoint usually is, don't do that, they'll run away, they'll flee the country, and we'll be left without our rich people.
That doesn't sound too bad to me, being left without the rich people. Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that's a little bit of an idle threat. I think we can put the likelihood of that on the same level as trickle-down economics. It's a myth perpetuated by the people who benefit from it being believed.
Yes, France has rather high tax rates. They've got plenty of billionaires. Russia has rather low tax rates. People don't realize that. And their billionaires are all in London and New York.
But if you look at the Nordic countries, look at Norway or Sweden and Finland, which have very high tax rates, but also have much better situations in terms of distribution. So I think if we have the idea that, you know, we're going to have fewer billionaires, one would hope that's not a problem, I don't think. And in any case, where people are going to live is a different thing. And also, bear in mind, in terms of, it's often also suggested in terms of corporate tax, that corporations will move around looking for the lowest tax rates. But they do that anyway. But they still operate in the countries in which they operate. But, I mean, this is another issue with the inequalities is the whole issue of corporate tax evasion and how large corporations are able to not make their contribution. I mean, corporations talk about, you know, doing philanthropy and corporate social responsibility and so forth. But the biggest way a corporation contributes to society is by paying tax. And if corporations behave in such a way to avoid that at all costs, they really have no right to talk about social responsibility in any other format, because it's support of democratically run state that is the most important social contribution they can make, in my view.
A couple of minutes ago, I asked you if you thought the billionaires were afraid these days. But here in the United States, I think we got an answer from one of them, the richest man in the world, Jeff Bezos, who charged New York City $3 billion, demanded $3 billion for the privilege of hosting his second headquarters company. So here we have the rich demanding tribute for the presence of their empires.
That's terrible. And obviously in the U.S. context as well, I mean, we can't have this conversation without mentioning one of the most famous billionaires, not that we know this because we haven't seen his tax returns, Donald Trump. And the fact that the American people will vote a self-proclaimed billionaire into the presidency suggests that there is some kind of adulation of the very rich built into society as well, not just in the U.S., elsewhere as well. But the Trump presidency really does indicate that the very rich still somehow have an appeal. I think, you know, I'm kind of reluctant a bit from Australia to talk about American culture, but I think this is also related to the kind of the history of the American dream, the idea that anyone can make it. But the fact is that it's only very few who make it. But still, you know, a billionaire president suggests that many people don't think there's anything wrong with extreme wealth.
Yes, in fact, studies have shown repeatedly that there is less upward mobility, movement from one class to another upwardly in the United States than in Western Europe.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting, especially given, you know, most of Western Europe has a history of a much more rigid class system and history of feudal systems and, you know, systems of kings and queens and so forth. So you expect it to be the other way around, whereas on the other hand, you know, the American experiment built on the ideal of democracy. But we need to look at what's actually happening, not at the promises. And as you say, you know, social mobility is important. But then again, when you have policies where education, for example, becomes much easily accessed by people of wealth and social networks and opportunities and healthcare, one would expect this to have a negative impact on the possibilities of upward social mobility that you describe.
But Bill Gates, the big billionaire, gives billions or directs billions of dollars to education. However, critics say that he's trying to create an educational system that is more supportive of, tolerant of, and nurturing of big businesses and billionaires like himself.
Yeah, and I would entirely agree with that. That is the system. And if your ability to get an education is dependent on whether a billionaire will hand you some money rather than a basic human right of every child who is born in a particular country, that is not equality. That is controlled by the rich. And also, I mean, as we mentioned before, you've got to ask, where did Bill get all this money? Well, through very predatory, monopolistic, exploitative business practices. So again, you have a system that's created the wealth, and then the wealth is then used to do these notionally kind of good deeds, which serves to reproduce the system that created. That's not progress.
And of course, the billionaires have plenty of money to create or suborn political parties. And in most of the West nowadays, there are no parties of labor, at least not in practice.
No, I mean, even in Australia, we still have a party that's called the Labour Party, but it's not entirely recognisable from socialist origins. And of course, that goes hand in hand with the power then of political lobbying as a means through which to control governments through very particular practices. And this kind of, you know, corporate spend on lobbying activities has increased significantly in terms of producing laws and regulations that are favourable to corporations. Again, something that we've seen exacerbated in the U.S. with the Trump presidency. Not the lobbying, but the policies.
What are the limits of society, of people at large, as they see the rich getting richer to the point where they can now recognize the faces of those who actually control the world?
Oh, I know. I mean, particularly with CEOs who are now, you know, many of whom are celebrities. And they're kind of heroes who, you know, children, you know, grow up wanting to be like them. I mean, there was a time in recent history where people who were chief executives or business people in general were considered rather kind of boring and drab characters, you know, the organization man and the man in the gray flannel suit. But today there seems to become a celebrity culture around CEOs. So the Davos meeting, for example, sees, you know, actual movie stars and celebrities mixing with CEOs and politicians as they all have fun in the snow talking about the world's problems. So, I mean, part of the system that's been used to justify this extreme wealth has been the celebrity culture that CEOs have involved in. So, you know, Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, Bezos, they're household names who are admired by many people, generally white men as well, by the way.
Yes, no sooner had Barack Obama left the presidency than he went off to an island owned by a British billionaire for fun in the sun with his wife. And Obama's black fans back here on the ground didn't seem to mind a bit.
Yeah, Richard Branson. And Branson really exemplifying one of the very first contemporary examples of this CEO celebrity as he became rich and famous through the 1980s and 90s. Yeah, this was, you know, on the pages of magazines as seen as being a great thing. So again, this just goes to reinforce the system that produces and maintains inequality at epic levels.
Madame Defarge of the French Revolution and her favorite utensil, the guillotine, seem so far behind us.
Yes, I'm not seeing any contemporary examples of the guillotine being replaced by a pedestal, it would seem.
That was Carl Rhodes of the University of Technology in Sydney, Australia.
Lots of people call themselves feminists, but the Feminist Project looks different based on history, race, and geography. Dr. Alicia Decker is a professor of women's gender and sexuality studies and African studies at Pennsylvania State University. She's also co-director of the African Feminist Initiative, which is currently publishing a new issue of its journal, Meridians.
The African Feminist Initiative was started in April of 2015. It grew out of a condition of struggle, one might say. There were a number of us that were located at our university that were feeling marginalized, not only within the space of women, gender, and sexuality studies, but also within the space of African studies, and feeling like there was not a recognition of the critical intersectional work that takes place between these two very different interdisciplines. And so the African Feminist Initiative was a response to feeling marginalized by this experience. So what we have been able to do now over the last 3.5 years is convene a series of meetings and conferences with African feminists, literally from all over the world, but especially from the continent, to get together to talk about issues that are of critical importance today as well as historically. And what we have tried to do is privilege the voice of those who are on the continent, because oftentimes they are the ones who are not heard, who are ignored, not purposely. I think a lot of times in the U.S. Academy, the excuse is that it's really expensive to bring people from Africa to participate, or it's hard to find these people and we wouldn't even know where to begin. So what we wanted to do was say, hold up, this is the kind of critical work that has to happen if we're going to have any conversation about African feminisms that is not rooted in colonial structures. And so we have, as much as possible, tried to bring scholars and activists and artists from the continent to the U.S., but we've also tried to bring U.S.-based Africanist and African scholars back to Africa to also engage in other conversations. So, for example, a couple of years ago, we held a conference in Morocco that was looking at the issue of African Muslim feminism. And that was an opportunity for us to really kind of discuss critical issues in the field. And we are now having another conference here at Penn State in April, where we're bringing about 35 scholars in, most of whom are from Africa, 15 or 16 of whom are currently living on the continent, to again talk about another critical issue that we're interested in exploring, and that is the construction of African feminist history. Who gets to write history? What counts as history? Who are the gatekeepers to historical knowledge? And how might a transnational feminist perspective or perspectives reshape that kind of knowledge production?
From what you've learned so far, what are the similarities between the challenges that are faced by Black feminists in the West, in the United States, mm-hmm. and in Africa? And what are the differences?
One thing that immediately comes to mind is this question of authenticity and of Black feminists throughout the world being forced to make a choice between their identity politics and their feminist politics. So, for example, we had a conversation last week through the African Feminist Initiative dialogue series where we talked about who gets to claim this identity of Africanness, and what does it mean when you're in a space, say, for example, an African university department, and you start to talk about feminist issues. What often happens based on our colleagues' experiences is that they're silenced. It's un-African to talk about queerness or to talk about feminist issues. And I think that, you know, a similar kind of silencing takes place among Black feminists in the United States as well. This idea that you're somehow selling out to your community if you embrace feminist and or queer politics. So that would be something that I see as a very much a parallel issue. One of the biggest differences, I think, in terms of the politics of Africa versus the United States is the kinds of issues that become politicized or become feminist. So, for example, in Uganda, land, and not even just Uganda, but actually many African countries, but I'm thinking about the controversies around the land bill in Uganda most recently, and who has access to land, who has access to water, who has access to these kinds of resources that are imperative in order to survive in a very difficult global environment in which we're all living. And so I think that in the U.S. Academy, oftentimes our students and even colleagues don't realize why something such as water or land rights might be feminist issues. And so the dialogues that we're able to have between those who are based on the continent and those who are living and working in diaspora are really important to show that there are ways that we can build solidarity across difference, but also through, you know, parallel struggles.
Here in the United States, one of the salient aspects of the Black Lives Matter movement is how it prioritizes queer issues.
And I think that that's been an issue that has been a sticking point for a lot of older African feminists, as well as new generations of younger feminists. And one of the things that comes up in our introduction to this special issue of Meridians is a conflict that played out about a year ago when some individuals on our listserv were referring to each other as dear sisters. Dear sisters, let's focus on XYZ. And one of our colleagues who's in Kenya wrote back a very pointed email and said, I don't identify as a sister. I'm a genderqueer individual. Does this mean that I can't be part of the AFI? And so we ended up having a very rich virtual dialogue with our members online about the politics of sisterhood and who gets included and who gets excluded. And so I think that within the histories of African feminist activism, there has been an assumption that heterosexuality has always been the norm and the standard for African feminist work. But what we're really realizing is that that's far from true, and that there is a whole variety of queer experiences that need to be foregrounded in the work that we're doing. And so kind of revisiting these old texts that insist that African feminism is not about sexuality, that sexuality is a luxury. And in fact, showing that we're just not paying attention to the theorists who are actually arguing the opposite. And so what I think this special issue is doing really well is showing the versatility, the variety of those who get to claim the feminist label, if there was such a thing, and or to participate in this, you know, this larger struggle that some might call sisterhood, others might call feminist solidarity.
That was Dr. Alicia Decker of the African Feminist Initiative, speaking from Penn State University.
Dr. Maha Maruwan is also part of the African Feminist Initiative and a professor at Penn State. Dr. Maruwan teaches African American Studies and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies. She was born in Morocco. Maruwan says Muslim women in the United States are especially vulnerable to discrimination and attacks.
Absolutely. And that's very problematic because, as you're saying, sort of Muslim women, especially those who wear the scarves, are very visible. And that makes them very, very vulnerable. And I mean, we saw this incidents on trains where Muslim women are being spat on and shouted at. And also, I think, you know, what's also dangerous about it is this idea that these women who wear the scarves are oppressed, right? Because it is absolutely not true. Many of these women wear the scarves because, of course, they want to. And they wear it for many, many, many different reasons. That could be religious, it can be cultural, it can simply be sort of a fashion statement. What we don't understand is that in so many Muslim cultures, wearing a scarf is also a fashion statement. And so the idea that a woman who is wearing a scarf is either oppressed, she's made to wear that scarf by a man in her family, and that she's oppressed. And, you know, these stereotypes don't help the Muslim community because they also show Muslim men in a very bad light as the oppressors, which is, again, not true and very problematic. And in addition, of course, I think at the center of all of this is that Muslim women feel deeply frustrated because no one bothers actually to ask them what they think and how they feel. And, you know, Muslim women say, look, we do not need saving. We are just fine. If you want to know about us, you ask, but don't make these assumptions.
The area of the United States most deeply associated with racial and ethnic hatreds is the South. And you've done a study and some video work on voices of Muslim women in the U.S. South.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I did a documentary based on my conversations with Muslim female students at the University of Alabama, where I worked at the time. And the number of Muslim students then at the university was very, very small, except, of course, for the international students. And I knew these students personally. They would come to my office and tell me about the sort of the myriad of negative experiences they had and the assumptions that others have about them, including their professors, who will make very racist and problematic comments, even in the space of the classroom, right? And I remember one of the students told me that a professor who was talking about studies abroad told the class, do not go to the Middle East, they will cut your head off. And the professor did it in front of the student, knowing very well that she comes from a Muslim background. And the student felt hurt, not just because of how unprofessional the professor was, but also because none of her classmates said anything to protest those kind of statements that are damaging to Muslim students.
Well, of course, the U.S. South is the most heavily black region of the country. And until rather recently in history, the majority of Muslims in the United States were black.
Absolutely. And so, as you say, sort of historically, in the South and in Alabama, where I was working, yes, the Muslim community was the African-American community. And so many of my students from the African-American community were Muslim. Of course, the assumption is that African-American Muslims are converts, right? Which is, of course, wrong, because Islam historically as a religion has been part of the U.S. and there is a long legacy of African-American Islam in the U.S. And it was interesting to talk to my students, my African-American students who are Muslim. Many of them are not visibly Muslim, right? They don't wear the scarf. And I'm talking specifically about the girls. But I remember one of my students who insisted on wearing her scarf and being exposed to a lot of harassment that was sort of a racial nature, right? So other students, and I also talked to white Alabamians. You know, one of the girls that I interviewed in my video was a white convert to Islam. The African-American student I spoke with, she was being called Harriet Tubman for wearing the scarf, and she was called the N-word. And so it was very interesting to see how, to see sort of the reactions she got as opposed to the white American student. The white American student, despite the fact that she wore the scarf, she was still protected by her whiteness in the South. She didn't get the same level of harassment as the brown and black students. So that was a very interesting realization, and that tells you a lot about how deeply the history of racism and the legacy of inequality and segregation is in the U.S. South.
You're a member of the African Feminist Initiative. Most folks in this country do not associate feminism with Islam.
Mm-hmm. Again, that is also a very problematic assumption, and it has to do with what, you know, I talked about earlier, which is Muslim women are seen as oppressed, are seen as not having a voice. And when we see them that way, we don't think of them as women with agency. We don't think of them as independent individuals who fight for their rights, who can be just as feminist as any other, you know, sort of population of women. So I think it's deeply problematic to exclude Muslim women from feminism. And it is, in fact, for that reason that Muslim women are not open to joining sort of what we traditionally call the Western feminist discourse, because they feel that they are being overlooked. They feel that there is no attempt that's being made to actually include their voices and their experiences.
Yes, you said that some folks here in the U.S., their reaction to Muslim women is feeling that they need to protect them from Muslim men. And we see that projected on the national scene by U.S. policymakers justifying U.S. occupation and wars in the Muslim world as crusades to protect women.
Absolutely. Crusades to protect women and to liberate women. And this is part of a long colonial discourse that has always exploited the image of the Muslim women to justify violence in those regions. And I can think sort of back to the 18th century. And it was interesting because sort of the narrative that you see about Muslim women, especially, you know, those who cover, if you read colonial narratives from the 18th century, there is this whole fantasy about these women. Who are they? How do they look under those garments? But if you look at the sort of the French colonial discourse, And as someone from North Africa, someone who grew up in Morocco and is familiar with the history of French colonialism, that the French, one of the things they did is that they forced women to take off their scarves because they associated liberation with looking Western. And so in order for these women to prove that they were liberated, that they were independent, they had to imitate French women. They had to look like French women. There was never sort of a respect for these women's identities. And the fact, as you said, that they could be both feminist and wear a scarf. And I mean, you know, and history tells us about this, for instance, the Algerian resistance and Algerian women's involvement in the resistance movement against the French and how fierce they were in their political involvement. And in fact, you see this throughout all the Muslim world. Sort of Muslim women have always been very politically active, very politically involved, and very politically aware. And yet we continue to construct them as victims because, as you said, that makes it easier to basically commit violence against these Muslim regions. And on top of it, it makes it easy to demonize Islam and see it as a foreign religion. That, again, in the context of the U.S., although you have a very large Muslim community in the U.S., and as I repeat, the majority of them are not converts, right? Islam has been part of the U.S. for a very long time, and yet U.S. policies, the media continues to see Islam as foreign to the U.S., continues to see Islam as a dangerous religion, as a violent religion, and it's systemic, right? Because it's very useful to do that. By demonizing Islam, it makes it easier for us to justify the violence against sort of Muslim regions.
You've also written about transnational feminisms. How internationally transmittable are the various feminisms in the world?
Oh, I love this question because that is exactly what I do. I teach courses on transnational feminisms, graduate courses mainly, but also undergraduate courses. I am co-directing the African Feminist Initiative. I am also the co-convener for the Women's Caucus at the African Studies Association. And so my feminism is very embedded in the work I do. My feminism is also very critical of how the West looks at women who are not from the West. And that includes the global South. And the problem with many women who are not from the West, from the US and Europe, is that they feel that their voices are not being heard, that their experiences are not respected, and that Western feminists are constantly making assumptions about them and tell them what to do and tell them how they can be liberated without even bothering to actually understand their histories and their experiences. And so transnational feminism was born out of that. And before that, we had third world feminism. So these were feminists from the third world saying it is impossible for us to form alliances with feminists in the West and to form solidarities with feminists in the West, especially in relation to white feminists specifically, because we also know that if we look at the history of feminism in the U.S., it was a white movement that also included women of color and women from other ethnicities. And so with transnational feminisms, the idea is let's all stand on equal ground and try to understand each other. Because the moment someone like myself, who is originally from Morocco, is being told that I am oppressed, that makes things difficult because I also want to know about how women in the U.S. are oppressed. And so when white feminists from the U.S. talk about feminists in Africa or feminists in the Middle East or feminists in South Asia, there's never a conversation about themselves too and the forms of oppression they experience. And so we are saying, let's all stand on the same ground and talk about all the different forms of oppressions that we all experience, right? We all know that we are all being challenged by patriarchy. We all know how patriarchy is affecting us. Women everywhere know that. And so, you know, a lot of the time, trying to think about how to save that woman in, quote unquote, the third world, in a way prevents you from looking at your own forms of oppression and gives you this fantasy and assumption that you are liberated. Whereas we are saying, no, actually, we all are dealing with different forms of oppression. And unless we are open and honest about it, we will not be able to learn from each other and understand each other and also form solidarities with each other. So the discourse of the white savior has to stop. We refuse to be seen as women who need saving because the reality is, as women, our experiences with patriarchy are real. They are different. They look different everywhere, but they are real. And I, as a professor of women, gender and sexuality studies, one of the things that I discuss in my classes is domestic violence, which is a huge issue in the United States. But often we associate those issues with women elsewhere. But we cannot do that. We have to have a conversation that involves everybody and that involves us standing on the same ground and actually making an effort and trying to understand each other's experiences and historical backgrounds and historical legacies.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.